ta chi 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 cha. Oh, that odd person is on the air again. I can't understand why they allow him to take up 45 minutes of valuable radio time when he could be doing really wonderful things like that nice Mr. Gambling does in the morning. He could be playing those wonderful pieces of music from the Norman Luboff Choir and giving us the time. And I love the way that nice Mr. Peter Roberts laughs so. He's such a funny man. Who is this odd person?
You don't know where it's ever going to end. I'll tell you, I walk into the Moose Hall in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Now, don't ask me why I went into the Moose Hall in Cheyenne, Wyoming, but I was in the Moose Hall in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and I noticed all over the wall they got plaques. Don't worry about it. You just watch me here, and then let's worry about that. You know, come on, off there. Let's go, Jerry. So I walk into the Moose Hall, see, and I see plaques all over the wall. You know, it says dedicated in honor of Charlie W. Gutstop, and it's the bar. See, I says, well, Charlie W. Gutstop obviously was important around the bar. And I go to the men's room, and right on the door of the men's room, it says, Charlie W. Clutterback, in memory of. I thought to myself, my God, here's a guy who's got a job dedicated to his memory. And somehow, I thought, perhaps, you know, that's not a bad monument. I mean, kind of, you know, it gets down to basics. I mean, it's not like a big statue of your face carved on the side of a mountain in the Grand Teton Range. By the way, how many of you would like to see your face up there next to Jefferson and Lincoln? How many of you can name the faces that are carved on the Mount Rushmore Monument? Did you know that there's a small face next to all the big faces of Madman Muntz, the late Madman Muntz? I will award a fig leggy with bronze oak leaf palm to anyone who can identify who Madman Muntz was. All right, let's all sing it together, gang. Bring it up there big, baby. Let's go. Yeah. All right, come on. Let's come on. Let's cut out with that vamping on a drum, and let's get going. Okay, all right. Enough of that talk. Let's go. Come on, man. Give them an inch, and they'll take a mile every time. Let's go. Yeah. Come on. Let's play it. Let's get into the words here. Come on. Let's go. Yeah.
Make it slow, boy.
All right. I'll take it slow. That's the only way to take it. That's the only way I've ever taken it. Let's go. All right. Cut it out. Hold it. That's out. Rouse Smith. Out. Very good. Now you reset that. Hooray for me. Ta-ta-ra-tee. La-ta-ra-tee-tee-tee-tee-tee. And, of course, that's not the only one. The other night, I'm watching a late television show, and one of my favorite actors of all time is Eugene Pallette. Do you remember Eugene Pallette? A little fat guy all the time, and he always looked like he had right on the edge of an attack of apoplexy. And, you know, he's always popping a little bit, and he had this deep voice. He was always saying, no daughter of mine is going to marry a newsman. No daughter of mine is going to out there hanging around with bohemian artists. You remember him? That's a pretty good imitation of him, too, as a matter of fact. But one of the great lines of recent times came on a late movie. And I'm watching it, see? Never know when you're going to get a piece of reality. And I'm watching it, and it's Eugene Pallette. And he's in a movie with, I believe it was Charles Boyer. And for some reason or other, Mr. Pallette is in the showbiz, and he's a night-type person, and he never, you know, his nightclub is working late at night and all that stuff. And here's this moment when Eugene Pallette has to get up early in the morning, and he's walking down the street with Charles Boyer, and they're walking through Midtown Manhattan at the time when all the civilians are rushing to work. And he's looking at him. See, old Pallette is looking. All of a sudden, he turns to Charles Boyer after looking around in bewilderment, and he asked,
what are all these people doing up so early in the morning?
And I've often wondered, what are all the people doing up so early in the morning? I don't know. Big Brother is watching you. I'm ticking it off there. Big Brother is watching you. Listen, you don't mind tonight if I bring up an unpleasant subject, do you? I mean, really? You sure? Now, don't say no without knowing what it is. People are funny that way, you know. They seem to take anybody who's in showbiz with a large grain of salt. See, so if you come on and, you know, if Johnny Carson or Merv Griffin or somebody comes on, he says, you don't mind if we talk about something unpleasant on air? I says, no, of course not. Just let him do it once. But I've noticed that what is one man's unpleasantness is another man's groove. If I may, you know, get real cliche-ful at that point. What are they calling? What's going on here? What was that? Madman Munce? I don't care about it. I know, we all know who Madman Munce was. Don't call up about Madman Munce. Please. He's in the state legislature. We know that now. He's heading one of the larger committees. Now, cut it out, will you? I don't want to hear about Madman Munce. Now, quit calling up here. You stay off my back, and I'll stay off yours, friend. But nevertheless, you know, if you bring up really something unpleasant, you'll find about 5,000 people out of a crowd will all of a sudden turn on because it's a thing that's been bucking them for years, and 528 million people will insist that you get eliminated immediately from the scene because it's something they have not been watching. I have noticed that whenever I mention cockroaches, for example, yeah, all right, yeah, you said you didn't mind if I talk about unpleasant stuff. You see, we got a lady engineer tonight, and she just turned green. But I've noticed that if you mention cockroaches, women get very nervous. They don't like them. And men instantly write in, and they want to hear more about it. Now, this is one, I'm not making any anti-woman or pro-woman remark. I'm just saying that I have noticed this from the vast amount of mail that comes in. That men say, oh, groovy, tell us more about cockroaches. I'll never forget the time once when I was in school. We used to catch cockroaches. We used to have these big derbies at night. And we would have our cockroaches painted green and yellow. And we would bet on them. You'd never get that from ladies. Ladies always say, Mr. Shepherd, you're usually so interesting. But the other night, when you mentioned cockroaches, I just had to turn you off. Now, if you would... And I've noticed, you know, there are other subjects like that. For example, when I play the jew's harp, I find almost without exception, women don't like the sound of it. No, they don't. They don't like the sound of the jew's harp, whereas men do. What is the jew's harp? It's none of your business. The listeners know. So if I play the jew's harp, I get thousands of letters from men saying, let's have more of that groovy sound. And... I get 5,000 letters from ladies saying, what is that awful Hogan twanging sound you have there? That's just terrible. So there are subtle differences between men and women that just don't show when the sun is shining hard and bright on Fifth Avenue. But tonight, I'm going to mention something. I want to bring up something. No, don't, Jerry, don't get him in the conversation about Madman Munce. Please, they'll spend the whole hour. No, please. Just say, thank you very much, zap. That's all there is to it. Now, tonight... I'm, as you know, for a long time, I have been the champion of a very, very definite maligned minority group. It's not so much of a minority group anymore, but I've been the champion of a maligned minority group. It began on a Saturday show I used to do. And it's, you know, I've always felt a relationship. You know, I think you can really tell a lot about a person by the things that he relates to. Now, for example, if you dig little foreign cars, that tells a lot about you. It does. It tells more about you than you'd care to have known in many cases. On the other hand, if you dig potted palms, and there must be somebody out there who likes potted palms, oh, God knows how and why. I have never been able to explain that one. But there are some people who are turned on, obviously, by them. And you know, there are even people who like plastic plants. Yes, you know, plastic trees. There's a place here in town that sells nothing but fake plastic plants. And I'm always surprised, you know, right down the street is a place where they sell the real thing, and he's not got any business. It's the guy with the plastic stuff that's got him coming in. Now, personally, they don't turn me on, but they obviously do other people. There are those who prefer a movie with a gigantic sex scene in the second reel to the real thing. Yeah, that all of a sudden everybody says, yeah. They understand that. Well, now that I've never thought of sex as a spectator sport, but there are those to whom it is obviously it is. And I can only feel a little compassion, and that's about the extent of it. But, you know, outside of that, there's hardly any connection between the one world and the other. There are those, for example, I've been reading in the Post now. Here's a typical example. I've been reading in the Post. They have this big series in the Post about dieting. Have you seen it? It's in the Post. The whole big thing, you know. It's written by a psychiatrist. Well, reading this thing is a little bit like going into the world of medieval theological religion. You know, one of the things that happened to religion during a certain period in the medieval days was that they forgot all about religion and began to count the number of angels that danced on the head of a pin. And I had that buzzing feeling today. I'm in the A train, and I'm looking at this thing, and you know, there's all kinds of things. It turns out that if you eat anything, there's obvious sickness involved. I mean, if you drop in and you get yourself a beer, you're attempting to reconstitute a lost father image and all that jazz. And at no point does this psychiatrist ever admit that a lot of people just like to eat. You know, and hence, if you like to eat, you tend to get fat. There are a lot of people who don't like to eat, and hence they're skinny. But, you know, six of one, half dozen the other. And so ultimately, if you develop a giant Chinese wall of philosophical reasoning, you have to defend the Chinese wall. Speaking of Chinese walls, that reminds me, this is WOR in New York. Now make that note. I've just made the station break, and don't come later and say I didn't. It's WOR in New York. And we have with us tonight the fantastic Year One poster, which I'd like to point out to you, is still available. By the way, Lyle Vann just ordered one. He saw it. I had one hanging in my office, and Lyle Vann came into the office, very official newsman, you know. He came into the office, and he looks a little bit like Adolf Manjou should have looked. And he walked in, he took one look at this thing, and what he said, I can't quote on the air, because Lyle's a very dignified gentleman, except he asked where he could get one. And I told him, I said, send $2, Lyle, in check or money order to Year One, 460 West 34th Street, New York, New York. It's a fantastic poster. It says about 5,000. You know, you can always tell you're onto something good. Either people love it or they hate it. Nothing that is really interesting in this world, really interesting, is ever neutral. Whether they're politicians, whether they're philosophers, whether they're novels, whether they're posters. And people, you either hate it or you love it. And that's the end of it. And it's a groovy, I happen to dig it. It's called Year One. It's a beautiful lithograph poster. And it's definitely worth the $2. And if you don't think it is, they'd be delighted to send you $2 back. Money back, if not totally flipped. Year One, 460 West 34th Street, New York, New York. Don't write to me. I am not Mr. One. However, you remember, I was one of the first champions of the starling. You recall that? A very maligned bird, the starling. And I've been conducting for a long time an independent study. Now, you see, there's the difference. Shepherd relates to the starling. Now, you know, very official people, they relate to birds like eagles. you know, they'll relate to something like bluebird. You know, I'll never forget the bluebird. Was there such a thing as the bluebird of happiness? No, I can't buy that. I will not countenance that. I will not. I can remember. No. I don't want to hear any more about that. I remember my Aunt Emily. She had a record. And I don't know who it was on the record, but it was some guy with a very loud voice. And she used to always play this. And can you give me a little echo chamber? Do you know how to give me an echo chamber? It went something like this. I remember him saying, oh, the blue bird of happy. I said, oh, my God. You know, even at the age of 9, the idea of a bluebird of happiness sitting on your shoulder, whispering sweet nothings into your ear, was enough to, if I can quote Dorothy Parker, make me want to throw up. And, in fact, I did twice under the ferns, second time I heard it. But there are a lot of people who, you know, buy this sort of thing. There are people who really think Rod McEwen is a great poet. You know, that's, of course, the same crowd thinks that Lawrence Welk is a fantastic musician. Well, you know, there are those who really like tap dancers. In fact, my old man loved tap dances. He used to love tap dances, especially if they went up and down steps. You know, they'd have to go up and down steps before they made it with him, you know. And, well, I mean, yeah, you know, who's going to argue with aesthetic judgment? Now, watch, I'm going to get a lot of angry. Oh, you should have heard the angry letters I got from people because I mentioned the other day that I cannot stand organ music of any type. Anytime anybody mentions E Power Biggs, instantly there's something inside of me that turns vaguely green, you know, like a swamp. I have to run out, you know. And I run to one-man bands, to be honest with you. You know, I like to see, yeah, one-man bands. You ever heard a good one-man band? Well, don't you know what a one-man band is? I remember one time when I was, oh, no, listen, one of the great unsung artists, because you see, a real artist is constantly fighting public opinion. A true artist, very few artists are ever applauded, really. Popular entertainers are. Now, you can be a popular entertainer in an esoteric field. For example, you are not going to get booed and hissed off the stage because you play the harpsichord. A lot of people are going to walk out, but they're not going to boo and hiss and throw tomatoes at you, because the harpsichord is an official esoteric instrument. If you come out on the stage and you play the lute, you know, a lot of guys are going to start blowing their nose and coughing a lot, but nevertheless, they're not going to holler, "Hey, cut out with a lute!" No, no, not at all. Not because, "Hey, what's that stupid thing you're playing there, huh?" Oh, no. But when you play the Jew's harp, you get that. You do. You get that all the time. What is the Jew's harp? If you don't know, you'll never understand. It's like Louis Armstrong once reportedly said about jazz. If you don't, you know, if you got to ask a question, you'll never know. And that's just the way it is. And so there's certain people who just automatically fall into the right categories. I wish at the age of 3 I had related to bluebirds. Yes, and if I had grown to love lovebirds and budgies and all those nice things, I could have gone on to become Merv Griffin. Oh, yes, he believes in that sort of thing. You know, kids and wives and lawns and stuff like that. What would Alan King be today without a lawn? That's just a philosophical question. He'd be nothing. He'd be working down at Ratner's, probably, you know, selling onion rolls. That's about the end of it. Well, all right. So here I am, you know. I don't believe in lawns. I don't believe in budgies. I don't believe in bluebirds of happiness. I do not believe there's a Ford in my future. If there is, you know, so I'm going to be a little worried. So that's true. And I'll never forget the first time. No, I'm serious. You know, you get pulled into these things. You know, it says a penny saved is a penny earned. Well, I kept putting my money in my bank. I had this little bank shaped like a frog. And, we had this calendar that hung over the icebox when I was a kid. It said a penny saved is a penny earned. And it was done in cross stitch. See, my mother believed in that kind of stuff. She also had a radio that was always playing Bing Crosby. And he would come on. He would always sing about riding along in my old V8. Do you remember that? Oh, it's great stuff. He used to sing something about the... No, it was, what was it? He used to sing a Hawaiian song. I remember all the time. My mother would actually weep when he'd sing about that Hawaiian place. Sweet Leilani, heavenly flower, ho. Well, there are people who buy that jazz. You know, really. And, of course, I grew up in a family that did. My mother, I don't know how she related to Sweet Leilani, but she did, you know. And there are people who actually believe that the lyrics of a Beatles song are deep. They're really deep, you know. Well, that reminds me of the people who, you know, thought that Edgar A. Guest was deep, you know, because he used the good words like home, mother, truth, beauty, love, you, me, dear, baby. And all are, you know, those are buzzwords. See, well, there are those who light up when the buzzword hits them. See? I'm going to give you some buzzwords. You ready for buzzwords together? I'll let that one soak there. Wow, let's throw it out again. Together. Well, together. And it's just the word itself. Together. You know, people love that. How about that love? That's a buzzword. Love. We'll use that. So let's try that one. Love. Love. I mean, that's a buzzword. Moon. There's a buzzword. Peace. There's a goodie. Oh, yeah, it's a groovy one. Understanding? These are all buzzwords. Understanding means you listen to me. That's what that means. Meaningful dialogue means do what I say, generally. That's what a meaningful dialogue is. And if you don't, you're a rat fink. And obviously a fascist to boot. So, so these are all buzzwords. And some people relate to them and others don't. I mean, and if you do, there's no explaining it. I mean, it's real to you. You do. My mother used to weep, you know, when Sweet Leilani came on. And my old man used to sit there and just drink Pabst Blue Ribbon beer when it came on. And say, he related to that, which is something else, of course. You know, there you go. You know, some people go for Lager, others go for Pilsner. Have you heard the commercial lately that says, at last, a light beer that tastes good? That's a breakthrough. That's going to surprise my old man. He never found a beer that didn't taste good. Even the stuff he made in his own bathtub, you know. He used to make, you know, but that's something else, you know. You get deeply involved in this one. Did you hear that commercial? Of course, commercials run to that kind of thinking, you know. You can go on and on with the commercial world because, sometimes it doesn't make any difference one way or the other if you believe that stuff. On the other hand, I really would like to live in a house where they're so rich that they call a lady plumber, you know, because they got a tea stain in a sink. I kind of like that. But you don't mind if I talk about starlings tonight? Have I got your approval, all of you out there? Well, now, you know, if I just talk about starlings, you wouldn't buy it. Because you'd say, well, who's this guy? He's defending these rotten, crummy birds. I mean, you see, it depends on who does it. That's very important. I mean, if Picasso paints a big, you know, bad painting, everybody flips. And they hang it up. Nobody argues about it. See, but if your cousin Clara paints that same painting, oh, get out. So, I'm serious. It isn't really, a lot of it depends on who you are when you do something. Believe me, it's a fact of life. And so you have to accept that. Just because you have thought great thoughts in your time doesn't make a bit of difference, old Ollie Dildock. Doesn't matter. I mean, it'll never work because you're working at the Esso station. Now, nobody pays any attention to you anyway. You see, this is true. If you know a person too well, that you just can't get any votes. Can you imagine? Oh, yes, this is a fact. You know that Lincoln's law partner, I mean Abraham Lincoln, to the last of his days maintained stoutly that Lincoln was a dildock and he personally would have made a better president than Lincoln. Why? Because they shared a desk. I mean, you don't think that Martha Washington thought that George was the father of the country, did you? Get out. Anybody who wears wooden false teeth, for crying out loud, what are you talking about? Get out. And so there you go. You know, six of one, it's half a dozen of the other. I mean, believe me, if Mike Nichols was to direct your home movies, they'd win Oscars. And that's all there is to it. It's just simply that way. And I would like to quote tonight The Listener. Now, this is the official organ of the BBC. And, you know, the British Broadcasting Corporation, very official broadcasting corporation, not like us. You know, we're not official. No, not at all. And, of course, they are. And so they have a magazine called The Listener. I'll never forget the first time I really ran into the BBC. I'm in a hotel room of a 10th-rate hotel in Dublin. And I want to tell you, no hotels get more 10th-rate than a 10th-rate hotel in Dublin. Yeah, oh, gee whiz, I mean, really, it was a flop house, actually. It was a Dublin flop house. And so I wake up about 4:30 in the morning, and you could smell the oatmeal fermenting down the air shaft. And it was an old guy that kept working this. They had a hand-driven manual elevator, you know, the kind you pull the ropes up with a big chain and all that stuff. And he just kept going up and down this thing. I guess he figured he'd keep in practice, and you could hear it squeaking. And he'd just keep going up and down all night long like some terrible sea hag out of the Sargasso Sea. And I'm laying in this room there, and they had a mattress that was made out of old coconut shells or something. I'm lying on this thing there. You know, who knows what had happened on that thing over the years. See, I'm lying there. I wake up, and I don't know what to do, and it's kind of clammy in this place. And at 4:35 in the morning in Dublin, you don't get up and run out to the McDonald's and grab a hamburger. You know, they don't have any of those amenities of life. And so I'm sitting there in the dark, and I turn down my radio, which I have with me all the time. Whenever I travel, I turn it on, and on comes the BBC. And I broke in right in the middle of a program, just as it's coming on. You hear boom, boom, boom. somebody is playing what it sounds like the Swiss bells. And the voice stopped, and it was a pause. You know, the BBC will have pauses that go on, oh, maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks sometimes. And this pause went on pregnantly, and I'm sitting in this room, and I could smell the fermenting oatmeal down in the kitchen there, and I can hear this guy going up and down in the air shaft with his little old elevator, and it's in Dublin. I kept saying to myself, you are in Dublin. This is James Joyce's place. This is where it all happened. Clippity-clop, clippity-clop. See, I'm heavily influenced by Ulysses. Clippity-clop, clop, squeak, funk. And I'm sitting there, I say, oh, yes, you got to understand that writing about a place is much different than being in a place. It ain't the same, you know. It always is that way. I have a suspicion that all the writing about paradise and heaven is going to be a terrible, really, it's going to be a terrible letdown when you get there, and it turns out to be a Howard Johnson or something, you know. And so to stand around, and there's a long line of people waiting to get harps, and they're all trying to get them tuned, you know, and everything bad. But they're going to have parking meters and everything there. By the way, did you read in the paper that the guy that invented the parking meter just died? That's right. Right, he says, there was great public opinion against my invention, but the world has come to accept it, he said as he passed into the great beyond. So let's give him a salute there. You know, he's added a little to our life. But did you read about him? Yeah, this guy out someplace in the Midwest invented the parking meter. Well, so every man has his own thing. So I'm sitting there in this hotel room on the edge of the bed, see, with my radio turned on. All of a sudden, the lady's voice came on, and she says, today, in our bird lovers program, we are going to examine the life and the times and the interesting nesting habits of the plume-crested oriole. Oh, no. Oh, no. I could hear that thing going up and down. The old guy's going to the top floor to make sure he's still alive, and then you hear him going back down again. A lot of people do things just to make sure they're still alive. Be surprised. And I could smell the oatmeal bubbling away down there, see? And so I turned up the gain a little bit, and this lady says, the orange-plumed oriole, which is found south of Devon, is at its very best at this time of the year. We would suggest that all of you fortunate people who live in that area make sure that you spend time, particularly just at dawn, when the orange-breasted oriole is at his most exciting. At that time, you will hear the mating cry, which goes to-wit, to-wit. Just two notes, to-wit, to-wit. Oh, no, to-wit, to-wit. Yes, the orange-breasted oriole is out there now trying to make the scene. And I'm sitting in James Joyce's 10th-rate hotel overlooking the beautiful Liffey. And I can smell the oatmeal down there in the long and far gone and past basements, the kitchens of the world, and the time and life in which I've been thrown. Oh, Molly Bloom, we salute thee as time and clippity-clop, clippity-clop, it marches on. Clop, clop, clip. Yeah, yeah. Hold it, oh, that's enough, that's enough, that's enough, that's enough. Hold it! I said, stop, that's enough. Don't give them too much. See, just you want to whet their imagination. You want them to say, I want more of that. I would like to hear more of the orange-breasted oriole's mating habits. Well, from the tonight, I quote from the listener. It's about, they have a program all about starlings. And you know that there's a scientist over there who has developed an entire world of starlings. In fact, he has a program on the BBC that is devoted to nothing but the starlings. And I would like to read a little of it to you tonight. The starling is probably the most successful bird in the world. And the secret of its success is opportunism. The starling is a make-out bird. In case you're curious why you hate that bird. You know, people universally hate two birds. Starlings, yes you do. You just don't know what I'm talking about. You're confusing the European starling with the starling. No, people don't like starlings. They don't like starlings, they don't like crabgrass, and they don't like owls. As a matter of fact, James Thurber once said, if you let 5,000 doves loose in Yankee Stadium, everyone would applaud. if you released six owls in Yankee Stadium, there would be a riot in which 25 people would be killed and the police would be summoned immediately. This is true. In fact, did I ever tell you about the guy who lived outside of Milan, Indiana, who grew a lawn of nothing but crabgrass? No, he planted crabgrass. And they signed a petition. The guy was driven out of town. And he mowed it. He kept it nicely trimmed. But crabgrass gets people where they live. So do starlings, and for the same reason. It's almost impossible to kill crabgrass. It's almost impossible to kill starlings. You ever hunted starlings? Oh, man. They are smarter than Barney Google. They are smart. And people are impossible to kill. Man is ubiquitous. He will find a way. Polar bears are tougher, but who wins in a fight between a man and a polar bear? You'd be wise putting your dough on the little short guy with the cigar. I'm serious. And so we recognize in the starling and in the crabgrass the same characteristic that we have in abundance. There's only three or four creatures on this earth that we're battling it out for the final victory. And what is the final victory? When all is said and done, when everything finally declines under an advancing ice age, what's going to be left? Possibly the cockroach. There are several creatures. The cockroach, there's a lot of money betting on that one. The raccoon, believe it or not. The starling, crabgrass, and your cousin Clara. That's the way it's going to be. And we're jockeying for position right now. The starling is probably the most successful bird in the world, and the secret of its success is opportunism. It is not a large bird, just like man is not a large person. It's not a large animal. A lot of, you know, many animals bigger than we are. It's not a large bird. Crabgrass is not a big plant. Redwoods are much bigger than crabgrass. But it's tough. It is only about 9 inches long. Its blackish plumage is shot with iridescent metallic colors. For the breeding season, the bill turns a bright yellow, particularly in the male. Did you know that? When you see a bird walking around a starling with a bright yellow bill, he's looking for action. And that's the fact. Unlike many other birds, and this is what bugs us, in fact, unlike almost every other bird about its own size, which hop, you know, birds hop, the starling walks. In fact, many starlings will stride. You'll see them walking around with that smart look on her face. He runs, just like man. The starling is now one of the most familiar of the 200 nesting birds in the Western world. This has not always been the case. The Hampshire village of Selborne, this is in England, has perhaps 50 pairs of nesting starlings today. Yet 2 centuries ago, Gilbert White, the father of British natural history, said of the starling in his Natural History of Selborne, quote, "No number is known to breed in these parts." Do you know that by late March, a starling will have selected his nest site for the season? He defends it by song and by wing waving. Sounds like a lot of my friends. This double advertisement is usually enough, but any really persistent male contender is removed physically. He is just kicked off the nest. First of all, the starling is extraordinary in his ability to imitate other birds. Did you know that about the starling? It's an extraordinary sounding bird. Its sound has been described as a lively, rambling medley of throaty warblings, chirrupings, clickings, and gurgling notes, interspersed with musical whistles and pervaded by a peculiar creaky quality, which is strangely irritating to man. I am quoting the official ornithological notes on the starling. But the starling is a veritable one-man band. He's the voice of them all, quote, "For a reason no scientist understands, the starling incorporates into its song the voices of all the other birds. Starlings will also give their own impression of trains, babies, telephone bells, and all sorts of noises that it hears around it. It is reliably reported and has been confirmed from Ireland that a starling copied a referee's whistle so faithfully that a football match had to be called off. Yeah, well, all right now. Now this is a bird. This is a bird that that should be considered. Incidentally, do you know that the starling was mentioned by Shakespeare, an eccentric who thought that all the birds mentioned in Shakespeare should be allowed to live wild in the United States. Now, this is something you probably didn't know, how we got the starling here in this country. That there was a guy, and I don't know his name. Does anybody know his name? Anybody got it out there? You got about 9 minutes. Anybody know the name of this guy? Because he is a guy who has really made an impact on our time. You know, I've often felt that the people who make genuine impacts, that's all right, five's fine, that I've always had this feeling that people who make real impacts on our time are rarely mentioned in the official histories. We tend to confuse battles and legislative moves and stuff with things that happened to us. And yet you realize that there was one man responsible for bringing the starling to the United States. One person. We had no starlings here. They are not native to this country. And you know why he brought them to this country? He was a cuckoo on Shakespeare. He was not a bird nut. He was a Shakespeare nut. And he felt that all the birds that are mentioned in Shakespeare, in any of Shakespeare's plays or sonnets, should be allowed to live wild in the United States. And, of course, one of them was the starling. And I'll ask you a question. What play and in what context did Shakespeare mention the starling? If you're a real ornithologist, Shakespeare slash scholar, he did. And by the way, with approval. You don't know. Well, be surprised at the garbage the shepherd's got in his head. That's my problem. I don't remember anything important, but I remember that kind of jazz. But nevertheless, he brought the first starlings to this country because of that, and he had 80 birds. He brought 80 starlings here. Now, do you know where he released them? I don't know whether I'll tell you this, if you know that little about your time and your place. All right, I'll give you this information. Central Park. He released 80 birds in Central Park, and this happened in 1890, which is only, well, 80 years ago. 80 years now. And in that time, the starlings went so, you know, completely took over that there are now over 500 million starlings in America alone. And originally, he was only found in a little part of Asia and a small portion of Europe. And now he is spreading all over the globe. His empire extends to 5 of the 6 continents. He is now the most common wild bird in the world, and in almost every place in the world, his numbers are increasing logarithmically. And they figure that by the year 2000, do you want to hear more things about the starling? You know that the starlings travel. One of the most wild things about the starling is that the starlings have a specific route that they travel all over the world. There are 30 starling routeways that have been, like starling superhighways, that have been measured and have been beautifully mapped out. But every time they try to catch them by setting up something in there, they just make a detour and go around. But the starling, the starling is one of the fastest of the flying birds. Starling will fly when he's just in his cruising trim, as we say, as a pilot. A starling at cruise will travel around 45 miles an hour, which is a fast pace for a little bird 9 inches long. Incidentally, this starling seems to know about radar. One of the curious things about the starling is that great crowds of birds will suddenly fly into a radar field and then apparently sense this, and they will sheer off, and they can clock them on radar, and so the bird is very much aware. Apparently, he is fairly sophisticated electronically. But the great thing about the starling is the fact that the starling can adapt himself to almost everything. Did I ever tell you about the time I'm in Cincinnati And somebody, 2 o'clock in the morning, I walked out. This is when I first became really aware of the starling. I used to work late at night. And I was working, for those of you who don't know the significance of Cincinnati in connection with the starling world, Cincinnati is the Riviera of the starling world. It's like the Vatican for all true U.S. starlings. They descend on Cincinnati and cover it up like some gigantic, fantastic, climbing beehive of starlings. Every year at this time, millions of them descend on Cincinnati. Nobody knows why. They just, you know, kind of like that beer-drenched atmosphere out there. And one night, must have been 3 o'clock in the morning, I left this radio station where I was working hot. Oh, it was steaming hot. Temperature was maybe in the low 90s, but very, very humid. The humidity, probably 85, 90%. I walked out all by myself, and there's nobody. Whoa, easy, baby. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Just easy, easy, baby. Whoa, whoa, that's it. Sneak it in under me. There, now. Just keep it there behind me. Easy, there. And I walked out. You know, I love walking around all by myself late at night. And I walked out into the night. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. And I stopped by this all-night bar. And I had a glass of beer. Then I was walking down this long street, a kind of divided highway street, something like Park Avenue here, you know. It's got a parkway down the middle of it. And suddenly I saw a pinpoint of light just arch up into the air and explode in the trees. I said, what are they doing? They were shooting Roman candles at 3 o'clock in the morning into the trees. I walked down there, and it was a squad of policemen shooting Roman candles at the starlings. Millions of starlings were in the trees. And you know what? It was really bugging these cops, because the starlings loved fireworks. Every time they'd shoot these Roman candles off, the starlings would cheer for more, you know. They wanted the whole works, skyrockets, dago bombs, everything, see? So 2 weeks later, they decided to put aluminum owls. There was a rumor that aluminum owls scared starlings away from the courthouse. So they put aluminum owls all over the courthouse. And within 10 minutes, 30 million more starlings had arrived. All I can tell you now, in Cincinnati, there is a population of aluminum starlings. They dug aluminum owls. The starling loves everything. And that itself is enough to make you bug. A good brisk cape, you know, would help him. But no, he just digs it all. You know, starlings smoke cigars. Tell dirty jokes, too.